reason behind that was I just wanted to try and get sued by Cadbury's. I thought they'd, you know, try and kick it up first, and you know, be, I thought it'd be perfect for like a Daily Mail sort of article, like getting sued by the big cheesemakers.
Welcome to Brand New Taste, a podcast for brands in the food and beverage industry, focusing on new innovation and how understanding taste is vital to commercial success.
James, very warm welcome to the podcast. It's great to see you. We were just sort of going back over the first time that we met, talking about chocolate. It was before Taste had started. It was before you started either of your brands. We've learned a lot more since then on both sides, but here to hear about what you've learned about over the years, because you have not just one brand, but you have two brands. And so first of all, welcome, and maybe just give us a quick introduction to yourself.
Sure. So my name's James Cadbury. I'm the founder of Love Cocoa and Hip Chocolate. Set Love Cocoa up about 7 years ago. The inspiration was my great-great-grandfather, Sepp Cadbury's Chocolate. I'm sure we'll probably cover that in a bit more detail later. Then also we've got a brand called Hip Chocolate, which is a vegan oat milk chocolate brand, which we launched about 2.5 years ago. And that's in the likes of Sainsbury's, and that's growing really quickly.
Brilliant. And so the first thing I am going to start with is the name, because it's not a coincidence that your surname is Cadbury. So can you tell us a bit more about the story as to how your name played a role in you starting a business into chocolate? And has that name been a sort of a benefit or hindrance at times?
Sure. So yeah, my name, in terms of my family name, is Cadbury. So I grew up in Birmingham. Where Cadbury's set up the factory. Just a bit of history about that. They set it up in 1824, so coming up to the 200-year anniversary, which is crazy to think a brand's been going around for that sort of that time. But when they started, it was literally a little grocery shop in Ball Street in Birmingham, and they did nice teas and coffees eventually. And then they heard about the Spanish in Madrid had started to drink hot chocolate. Back then, it was completely different to a hot chocolate we know and love. It was literally water with some spices and some cocoa nibs, and they made that into a sort of cocoa-y drink. Cadbury's were really interested in that because they were quite religious people. They were Quakers, so they didn't believe in you know, drinking lots of alcohol. At the time, you know, lots of businesses were in city centres, and at the time, Birmingham, like London, was full of smog. It wasn't a particularly nice place to live. So what Cadbury's wanted to do was they wanted to create something which you know, would stop people drinking as much. So they came up with this cocoa drink, and eventually they went on to want to create chocolate bars. They wanted something for people who weren't just within distance of the stores. So people would come into the store, would smell that cocoa for the first time, and this was 200 years ago, so it was literally a completely different smell. Yeah. People didn't have those spices, which you can go to the supermarket and get 100 different spices now. There was literally, I think the diet was literally potatoes and vegetables and chicken, some sort of meat sort of thing. So it wasn't a huge amount going on. So sort of coming to this store and have that cocoa smell was something new for everybody. And from that, as I said, they went on to make the chocolate bars. And I think the key to their success was, having a product which was better than anything else on the market. It was purer. They worked for about 50 years on making this chocolate bar better than anybody else on the market. People at the time were putting potato starches in chocolate. They were putting apparently brick dust in chocolate to give it a bit of texture and colour, apparently, which sounds a bit crazy. But anyway, it's part of the journey, I guess, which they sort of saw and they wanted to improve on. And I think the real success was when they started to put milk into the chocolate. So before, chocolate was very dark, it was quite bitter, wasn't that interesting, and Cadbury's managed to work on how to put milk into their chocolate. We went through a number of trials, a lot of A-B testing, I guess, back in the day, in terms of trying to work out how to put milk in a chocolate. And from that, they sort of were super successful. I guess all that really, really, really inspired me. Growing up near the factory, I think I was about 3 miles away from the factory. I went to school in Birmingham. All our school trips were to the Cadbury factory. It wasn't a huge amount else to do in Birmingham in terms of sort of attractions to go to, unfortunately. So Cadbury was always number one. So I was just really, I guess, inspired and just found it super interesting to go to that factory. And, you go through, I don't know if you've been to the Cadbury World.
Yeah.
It's great. You sort of learn about the history. You learn about where cocoa's grown. And then you learn how it's made as well. So I was just hooked on it. I was like, I love chocolate. I just absolutely loved it. And I was like, yeah, I want to do this eventually. And, after university, went to, got a graduate job and did really well in that, but I just wasn't that passionate about it. So I was always thinking, well, yeah, when can I set up my chocolate company?
Okay, so from a child, basically, this is your dream.
Yeah, and no, I think so. I think it's, you know, everybody likes chocolate. I mean, I think, I don't know anybody who doesn't like chocolate. If they don't, I find them a bit weird. So I think so. It was always something. I was quite entrepreneurial at school. I used to trade like football stickers, or I think they're called Pogs, and they're like these little round things.
I remember Pogs.
Yeah, I went from like
I'm too old for Pogs. Yeah.
I can't remember what they were, but these little round things, and went from zero to having more than anybody else, and just training them with people. So I was always super interested in business and university. I did all sorts of weird things to get, you know, not make sure I didn't have to have a proper job sort of thing. So, and I was just very entrepreneurial, and you know, I also loved chocolate. So I was like, well, why can't I put those two things together? And I guess my naivety sort of led me into creating a Love Cocoa. Mm.
But so it was kind of a dream somewhat when you were younger, but it wasn't the first business that you started, because I think when we met, were you in finance or something? So you didn't go straight into chocolate with this idea. You were entrepreneurial in other sectors. What was the reasoning why you didn't go into chocolate sort of straight away? And then what was that catalyst for actually making the jump eventually?
Yeah, I think I just, like most people, wanted after university, I wanted a job where I could learn and have a manager, and, you know, rather than going straight into business when, you know, I was just a student, I didn't really have a clue. It was like, I want to have a bit of a grounding, learn. And I managed to get into a job in finance, which was, you know, working my way up from an operations role to trading derivatives. And we were moving billions of pounds around the world on a daily basis, but I just wasn't super passionate about it. So I sort of started helping a friend who had a business called Property Moose, which did some crowdfunding for property. So I helped him sort of set that up, and I sort of got the bug, and that gave me the confidence to really sort of have a proper business. At university, it was more, I'd sell all sorts of weird stuff on eBay and all sorts of stuff like that. And it was never real job, it's more make a bit of money sort of thing. But sort of having the bit of experience with helping a friend set up his business, that gave me that confidence that, you know, I can do this. It's before, you guess, it gives you, you know, it's just, it's that anxiety and sort of you going into the unknown that you're not really sure how things work or how to do it, and that's what was really stopping me, I guess, before. But then having that bit of experience gave me the confidence to really give it a real go.
Yeah, of course. And so then you decide, right, you want to get into chocolate. And what I made a note of is same values as your great-great-grandparents, you know, 200 years ago, being best in class, doing good as a brand. They were sort of part of your values. But you obviously knew your name was something that you could use, but how do you use it? Should you use it? Could you legally? And even if you could legally, should you, in terms of did you want to ruffle the feathers of Cadbury's and Mondelez? And we had conversations about this before you started. And yeah, it'd just be good if maybe you tell us what that journey was like, sort of thinking about those things, making the decisions that you did in terms of how to use your name as part of the brand or not, and what you've learned along the way, maybe.
Sure, yeah. I remember meeting you in I think it was an Irish pub. I can't remember what it was called.
But
it
sounds about right.
It was an Irish pub, a couple of Guinness down. I think you were working at Greeny Blacks at the time, and I sort of reached out to you and asked for some advice, and we nearly sort of went into something together. But no, it was super, super interesting to sort of learn from your experience and to ask you stuff. But in terms of the name, it was, you know, it's part of my, you know, it's part of me sort of thing. So, and, you know, I thought it's potentially going to be an advantage. I think having, you know, the Cadbury name and being from chocolate, it's certainly going to help from a PR perspective. So, you know, when we're thinking about launching and how we're going to do it, it was, you know, how much PR can I get? I don't have deep pockets. I literally put my savings into this business. People probably think I've got loads of Cadbury's money, but they were philanthropists, they were Quakers, so they didn't believe in creating wealth for future generations. So it was literally my savings from working in banking, and you know, put that together to set up the business. So any sort of thing I could do to get PR using my name, wherever it might be, was something I definitely wanted to do. You know, to market a product is super expensive. It's, you know, you can spend a hell of a lot of money on Facebook ads if you want, or you can get a bit of PR. So our strategy was really trying to get as much PR as we can. So using my name was really key to that. When we started, we didn't have my name, I don't think, on the front of the bar. Then we decided to put it on the front of the bar. Reason behind that was I actually wanted to try and get sued by Cadbury's. I thought they'd, you know, try and kick up a fuss, and, you know, be, I thought it'd be perfect for like a Daily Mail sort of article, like getting sued by the big cheesemakers, which when the Mondelez were cheesemakers, I guess, were there before they took over Cadbury. So yeah, it was really sort of trying to use that to the best of our advantage. And recently, actually, we've decided to remove my name. So I think it was great to start. I think people, you know, recognise that name, and it definitely helps when people sort of picking the product up off the shelf, as well as for PR. But we've actually removed it from the front of pack recently as part of a rebrand. The reason behind that was, you know, wanted to stand out on my own. Also, I think some people got confused potentially. So it was something that we just wanted to remove anything like that, and, you know, stand on our own two feet. Similarly, when we set up Hip Chocolate, it's something we've not actually used at all. Again, I just wanted to prove that, you know, I can do this without, you know, having to lean on my name and put the success down to that. So I think, yeah, use it to, you know, I used it to my advantage when I set up, especially when I didn't, you know, have much money to spend on marketing. But nowadays, it's something that we're trying to not avoid, but I don't think it needs to be prominent on the packaging. It's obviously a nice sort of secondary, third sort of story to tell people. And, you know, if they like the product, then suddenly they find out that, you know, set up by someone whose great-grandfather set up Cadbury's Chocolate. And I think that really is a nice little add to, but it's not the key thing anymore.
Well, I mean, it shows the strength of the brand that you built, which is amazing. It does remind me a little bit of us when we started Tasted. It was just the two of us. And then when we started to hire people, I think we leaned more on it being about us. But over time, we've realised that we can sort of take more of a step back, and it's about the amazing team that we've got. And you feel...
You didn't tell me this.
and you feel... You do feel pride that you've been able to create something that it can be sort of an entity on its own. And you've done it not just once, but you've done it twice. So this is the big question that I wanted to ask you. People that have started a food or beverage brand, especially in recent years, and know just how challenging it is, will be questioning, why on earth would you go and do a second one so quickly? What was the reasoning behind having two? And was it the right decision?
Yeah, really good question, actually. Something that, you know, played on my mind for quite a long time. So Love Cocoa was going really well. It's profitable. A couple of years ago, we had a really good couple of years, and you know, then we saw but Love Cocoa, just for your listeners, it's more sort of luxury, it's higher end of the market. We're in department stores. Eventually we want to launch our own stores, so something similar to Hotel Chocolat, but in a different way. But in terms of sort of growth, unless you have your own stores, you know, there is a sort of a cap and a ceiling with that. You're against lots of really old heritage brands, and it's hard to be able to grow super quick unless you're a grocery brand. But we really didn't want to have Love Cocoa in grocery. It wasn't, you know, it's a great brand, it tastes great, but, you know, going to grocery, you need to have a lot of money or something completely different about your product. And it wasn't quite the right route for us as a brand. And then I guess the Hip came from an idea. Lots of people in the office started to drink Oatly, and rather than us going to get sort of cow's milk, you know, start of the week sort of thing, we were getting oat milk. And led me to think, you know, look around, is anybody putting oat in chocolate? There's a few sort of vegan milk chocolates, but most of them were like rice-based or coconut-based, and a few almond-based as well. And I tried, I bought everyone, and everyone tasted rubbish, a bit like the milk. So, I think oat is the best alternative. It tastes the most similar to, you know, to cow's milk. It's very creamy, and also it's very sustainable. So that led me to thinking, you know, can we put that in chocolate? So we started to look at that, and realized that yes, we can. So we developed that for about 6 months. And for that, it was thinking, you know, we've created this product, but do we create a new brand name, or do we put it under Love Cocoa name? We already started to create a bit of brand equity with Love Cocoa as being a sort of luxury brand, and sort of suddenly having a vegan product which you're going to put into a grocery store would sort of, you'd lose that brand equity. So similar to, I get bits like Thornton's, when they 20, 30 years ago, they went from having their own stores to suddenly going into Tesco's and selling the product half price on promo. So sort of learned from that and thought, you know, we have to have a separate brand. We want to create this vegan brand and, you know, have it, you know, have its own set of values, and yeah, it just has to be different. So that was a real reason. It was different. You know, it is chocolate, but they are very different you know, brands, and, you know, who we're targeting. So it made more sense to create two separate. With that, though, just came a lot of additional work. There's, you know, not double the work, but there is, you know, a lot more work, and it, you know, is really challenging, and it does take a lot of time and sort of brain space as well. So I think ideally I'd recommend most people have one brand, but we just thought the opportunities was to have the two. And you know, has helped us grow and, you know, raise investment and whatever else, it was the right decision. But, you know, it is challenging. It's just, I think that's that brain space as well, to have enough time to dedicate to both brands. And it's something that I'm constantly working on to try and, you know, improve how I, separate my time and, do that better.
Yeah. And it makes sense as well, because you do see some people try and stretch a brand too much. And obviously, like you say, it is a lot more work, but not double the work. I'm guessing the shared resources, whether it's team members, assets, certainly experiences from Love Coco that have made you probably do things that hit sort of quicker, better, easier, maybe second time around. So it does make sense to, you know, the benefits or the opportunity.
I've seen experience of it when I was at Whole Earth Foods and Green and Blacks. And so Whole Earth was the original brand. Mm. That was no sugar, etc., all the products, and varied from sort of like jams, but maybe with apple juice and cereals and tin food and frozen food. But when Craig and Joe wanted to start Green and Blacks, it being chocolate, it needed sugar in it. Now you can get some no sugar ones now, but then it had sugar, and it was also, rather than something that was very sort of not worthy but whole foods, it's more of a luxury thing. It was chocolate, so they created Green and Black. So I've seen a similar thing, and that worked. And I think for the same reason, HIIT works, because you wanted to separate it out, and it would have been harder, I think, if you kept it under the same brand, especially in the communication side of things.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think that's the main reason. It was the communications. We wanted to have a vegan brand and, you know, have a tone of voice, communications, slightly different packaging as well. Love Coco is more sort of luxury, probably targeting slightly older people, whereas HIIT is definitely a younger vibe in terms of the packaging, branding, or whatever else. So, and again, also spreads a bit of risk. So being, you know, a young entrepreneur, you know, having two brands, you know, if one doesn't take off as well as I want for any reason, then at least we've got two sort of things. So I think that also spreads a little, you know, helps in terms of spreading risk. So I think there's a number of reasons we did it, and it sort of makes sense at the moment. Mm. But it's just, there's quite a lot of work, which I didn't quite realise.
Well, fair play to you. I don't think we'll be starting a second agency anytime soon.
No. Never say never.
Obviously, both brands are British, and I know export was something that you managed to sort of achieve quite early on with Love Coco, and you do with HIIT as well. And so has being British been important as a brand? Because if you think of the famous chocolate brands, if you are going overseas, are people looking for Belgian, Swiss, maybe even Italian or French? When they see a British chocolate brand, do you have some of that borrowed equity from Cadbury's? Just how important has being a British brand been in your export channels?
Yeah, no, I think it, you know, people do like British brands. There's lots of luxury British brands, you know, everybody is aware of. And I think, you know, when we are going to trade shows and stuff like that, people do stop at British stands probably more than some other countries. But no, it's a tricky one really to understand how important it is. You know, when we are exporting, we at the moment work with select countries, and we do it on a sort of relatively small scale. But in the future, it's something, if we do go into export, we really want to sort of go big and hard and, you know, go into those markets and try and make a difference. At the moment, it's a more of a test and learn process for us. So I guess over time, we'll get to know how important being a British brand is. Yeah. I think it will definitely has a you know, big impact in some countries, but, you know, potentially other countries not so much. So maybe trying to export a British product to France is probably going to struggle. Even like Italy, I think they're quite sort of precious on their own products, whereas, you know, a British product in the US potentially it would be, with the story and stuff like that, might work really well. So it's something that we are, you know, constantly thinking about in terms of how we launch in new countries and how we get that messaging right. But yeah, exports is tricky. It's, you know, just from our perspective, it's make sure the labeling is correct. Even Australia and US, who's both are, you know, English speakers, they have different nutritional tables. So suddenly you've got to have, you know, three different pieces of packaging to go into US and UK. Then if you want Canada, you've got to put French on it. So there's lots of these little things, and it just takes up a lot of time and brain space. And, you know, when we're trying to do it, we're trying to make it simpler as we can at the moment. So all X works now, and let people do the labeling requirement for us. And once we see a bit of traction, it's something that we'll sort of try and do a, you know, bit more of. But yeah, exports is tricky.
Can imagine. You've got one of, if not the best, tasting plant-based milk chocolate. And you just said that that was about a six-month process getting it developed, which actually doesn't, that sounds pretty good considering how well you've done. When I agree with you, especially when you started, the products that were just coming out to the market weren't that great on taste. What was that process like developing the recipe? Did you, because it seems like you found some early promise, but was there quite a lot of work to fine-tune and perfect, I'm guessing?
Yeah, no, there was a lot. It was, the first couple of samples were rubbish. It was like, we nearly quit the project sort of thing. It was just like, you know, well, we're wasting our time here. And to be honest, we pretty much gave up on it. And I think the fourth sample came in and was like, actually, this tastes all right, actually. This could be all right. And then we had another like three or four iterations on that, and we got to a stage where we're sort of, this is pretty good. This is definitely something we could launch with, get some customer feedback. And we launched something which probably wasn't perfect. It wasn't, you know, as good as we wanted it to be, but it was definitely better than anything else on the market. We want to be first to the market with oat and chocolate in Europe, really. I think there's one brand in the US which was awful, actually. It was really gritty and just didn't taste of chocolate. But yeah, it was the opportunity for us to be the first and sort of original oat milk chocolate. So we sort of pushed through probably a bit quicker than we wanted to, really. But since then, we've done lots of iterations and sort of haven't told anybody about it. But we're probably on to our fourth iteration in terms of how it tastes. There's lots of small, tiny little things we're changing production, which you can't really do in sampling. So really technical stuff, like changing the particle size and stuff like that, so it melts your tongue quicker. And yes, it's been a constant sort of process of, you know, trying the chocolate. It's like, just, you know, this tastes good, but, you know, could be definitely be better. So we just always try and improve it and make sure that it's tasting as good as possible. And I think once you, you know, happy with a product, you know, well, for us, we're never happy. We always want to keep pushing sort of thing. And I think that's really important to be prepared to do that. So once you've launched something, don't sort of take that as the final product, but be prepared to put that time and effort into, you know, try and improve it, because that's, you know, people come back, people try your product for the first time, but if you want people to come back and buy, it has to be the best tasting, right?
Absolutely. So yeah, sure,
that's what we've
learned. Yeah, and I think one of the challenges of developing sort of an oat milk based chocolate is, and I think people don't realize that the reason oats work so well is the creaminess from the starch. And that's replacing the creaminess from the fats that's traditionally in dairy milk. And other plant-based milks are also relying on fats, like with almonds and so on. But with oats, because it's starch, it's essentially sugars as well that you're sort of... And so balancing the sweetness, because what we've found when we've sort of looked at this category is with rice and with oats, you know, it's really hard to keep the sweetness from becoming sort of overpowering, because you're essentially getting the creaminess in with the sweetness. And I think that's what you've done really well on this, is balancing everything. So like you say, it's all down to the micron size of refining and the type of cocoa and the split between mass and butter and all of that. Do you feel like, you must feel like you're a chocolate expert now, surely? Certainly from when I met you 6 years ago.
Yeah, definitely. When I started, I didn't know what single origin meant. I couldn't get my head around it for quite a long time. So what's this single origin? What does it even mean? I hadn't got a clue. I literally came from a finance background and had no idea about chocolate apart from sort of really liking it. And it was mainly Cadbury sort of stuff I ate at the time. So it was, you know, a lot of learning to try and work on, you know how chocolate is made. And there's all those sort of small little details which make such a big difference. And with our hit product, we do put, you know, less sugar in than a sort of a Green and Blacks or a Cadbury's or whatever it might be. So it definitely has less sugars because of, as you said, the oat is slightly sweeter. But it is a balancing act. It's, you know, constantly trying to, you know, improve that and iterate it and to try and get to sort of a result which you're happy with, and get customer feedback as well. I think we take all our customer feedback, so you know, good or bad, we take it really sort of seriously and try and improve on the flavor, because that's what people come back for.
Yeah, I do think though that when you start learning in anything, so whether it's chocolate, which we've all worked in, I used to work in wine many years ago, once you start to learn a bit, you think, you realise how much you didn't know, but how much there's still to learn.
Yeah.
And I do think, even if you've been working it for a number of years, it's always stuff to learn, always.
Yeah, it's almost like the more you learn, the more you realise you don't know.
Yes, exactly.
You feel like a beginner. I just think of chefing and cooking. I mean, a year or two into chefing, I thought I was the dog's bollocks. I thought, you know, I was next Gordon Ramsay, because I'd sort of done a fancy plate of food, and I did my first terrine. I thought, ah, and then,
you
just
put caraway seeds on it. All
there we go. Inside joke.
Rubbish.
Let's talk about sustainability, because rightly so, so important in the chocolate category. Yeah. And you've obviously got two brands that you would have started when great work had already been done with the likes of Green and Blacks, and, you know, Mondelez, and even the big companies have had to kind of all be really hot on this area, making sure that farmers are paid fairly, treated fairly, that everything's being done sort of sustainably for the planet is obviously something that's become more and more important. What's that journey been like over recent years? Where do you sort of stand now on it as two brands? What do you think maybe the future holds for sustainability in this category?
A really good question. I think sustainability, when we launched the brand, it was really, really, really important. You know, learning about Cadbury's and what they did, some of the stuff they did, 150, 200 years ago was incredible in terms of, they worked only with specific countries who were sort of ethical. They stopped working with Sao Tome just off the coast of Africa because of slavery links and stuff like that. So Cadbury's were really, really hot on all this sort of things, even to the extent that they, when they built Bourneville, which was their factory, it was about 6 miles south of Birmingham at the time. Birmingham was full of lots of factories. It wasn't a particularly nice place to live in. So they wanted to create this garden factory. And within the garden, they planted trees, and they made housing for the employees, and they made sure that they all had trees and they could grow fruit and vegetables and stuff like that. So they were always really, really hot on this, and it was something that really inspired me. So when we launched, it was going to big trade shows and speaking to lots and lots of different chocolate suppliers, and rather than just going for the cheapest, or it was more sort of looking at, I want something that tastes great, but also want to understand a bit more about, where the chocolate's grown, how it's grown, what sustainability is involved in that. And there's a number of issues in the cocoa industry. I think Tony Chocolonely have, done really well in talking about, slavery within or child exploitation within the cocoa industry, and a lot of that is driven from, a lot of farmers, and it took me a long time to learn this, but a lot of where our cocoa comes from, it's literally family-run businesses. They've got a number of anything from a couple of hundred to a couple of thousand of trees, which they'll grow all their cocoa on, and then they'll probably work with a cooperative, then they'll work with another cooperative, will then work with a someone who'll bring the beans in from, Africa to the, Europe. And, what happens then is there's just less for the sort of the grower. So what happens, rather than if we pay the grower properly, then they'll be able to employ people, but they can't really employ people. So it ends up, they have to work very, very long hours, and then they drag their children into it. So rather than their children going to school, they'll literally be working on the farms, pretty much full time. So that's obviously a big issue. So when we set up the business, it was, for us, we wanted to be sort of really careful about where we sourced our cocoa from, and because of the issues with Africa and around that, we need to source it from South America. So that's something we've always done and looked to do. Then the other big issue in cocoa is deforestation. So again, what that means is that cocoa farmers, they want to grow more trees because they need more money to be able to pay the bills, and because they don't get paid enough, sort of thing. So it's a bit of a vicious circle. But what they'll typically do, especially in the likes of Ivory Coast, they'll cut down rainforests, which have got a beautiful, lots of animals there and beautiful flowers and plants, wherever else, and biodiversity. And what will happen is they'll grow a monocrop, be it cocoa. And as a result, we've, in Ivory Coast, I think 75% of their rainforests have gone in the last 30 years because of the cocoa industry. So that's a really big issue. When we heard about this and read about this, it was, how can we sort of give back? So we've planted about 1.8 million trees now with our Love Cocoa brand, which has all been done in Africa. Okay. Some of them been done by cocoa farmers, which we're sort of super proud about. And what these cocoa farmers have done, they've been able to have avocado trees, banana trees, all sorts of stuff, which helps with the biodiversity and makes the cocoa grow better and quicker. Those sort of issues we've always read about and sort of coming to understand more, and because of that, we sort of just wanted to make sure that we're as sustainable as possible. So, you know, plant trees, source, you know, it's ethically and sustainably as possible.
And it's just more and more important to consumers. Certainly towards, I mean, still involved with Green and Blacks, but certainly when I was, you know, there full time, sort of 6 years ago or so, whenever we were doing events and even when we were doing kind of big projects looking at, you know, whether it was repositioning on the brand slightly or new products and just doing focus groups, et cetera, for a number of reasons, we just saw that fair trade or ethical sourcing was just becoming more and more important. We always knew it was important, but it's just become really,
it's become
really
a must have, hasn't it? It's almost like you can't sort of have it as a, almost like a badge. It's like people expect it to happen.
Yeah.
And rightly so.
Yeah, and it's not just chocolate industry. I mean, obviously, you know, B Corp and so many other sort of things.
We've just gone through the B Corp and it was a lot of work, but we're glad we've got it. Everything's about 12 months and about 100 million questions and forms and whatever else, but no, really glad to get that.
I've never spoken to anyone who said, yeah, it was easy.
The problem is, I don't think a lot of consumers actually understand what it means, but I think hopefully that will come. But it's something that retailers obviously understand and want. And a lot of these sustainable stuff is for the retailers and sort of getting into retailers. Mm-hmm. I think if you don't tick those boxes, then you won't be getting those listings with the retailers. And I think consumers take a little bit longer to sort of catch up with some of these things. But
your team as well, because obviously, you know, we were just talking about, you know, it's not just about running a brand, you're running a business, running a team, and you want to retain good people, et cetera. And so I think things like that are important to the team as well.
Absolutely.
As we know. Just going back to the brand side of things, obviously you've now got two brands in the sort of one, let's say, would you say premium and one sort of super premium or upper premium? Are positioned slightly different. And when we first met and I was telling you how, if you looked at the three big premium brands in the UK chocolate category, they all had sort of gold embossed on them and very dark, etc. And that was just kind of how it had been done. Whereas you look at what you've done with Hip now, and there are other brands kind of pushing the boundaries a bit in terms of what is sort of appropriate or a good fit within a premium chocolate category. What was the decision behind going down this side of this style of branding with Hip? Because you were probably one of the first, actually, certainly of any note, I would say, that did sort of steer away from the norm a little bit and do something that was a bit different, a bit more sort of relax and hip.
Yeah. I think we had two in-house designers who came up with us. They're quite young, quite cool people, sort of thing. So it was sort of saying what I wanted and trying to come up with a vision. And then we went through, you know, it was quite a lot of work in terms of lots of things which weren't quite right. But what we wanted was something that looked different, something that stood out on shelf. I think some of the, you know, the Green and Blacks, the Lindt, probably brandings for a slightly older consumer. Whereas we knew our consumers are probably going to be, you know, first adopters are going to be slightly younger. Mm. So we needed to, you know, have slightly younger looking packaging. And also we want something that stands out on shelf, which is, you know, very colourful. I think, you know, getting onto shelf is hard enough, but sort of staying on shelf is even harder. So you need to, you know, especially if it's a new brand, you need, you know, people to see you on shelf sort of thing. And it can be quite easy to get lost on shelf. So we, you know, the couple of key things were, we want to make sure that people recognise the Hip brand, and also make it sure it's colourful. And also the other part was we wanted people to understand what the flavour was from looking at it. So we, you know, try and put something related to the products inside. So we've got cookies one, which has got a big cookie, sort of Oreo type looking thing on the front. So to make it stand out and people understand what it is. So that was the, you know, the branding, but we didn't have any branding experts. It was more something that we liked as a team. And luckily, like, all the feedback so far, everybody loves the branding. So it was a bit of, I don't think it luck, but it was, yeah, something that everybody managed to sort of do, and we sort of cobbled together, and you know, everybody seems to think it's great. So we've done something right, but I'm not sure how we, how we got there.
I think instinct sometimes is you rely on it. If you've, rather than going with a number of sort of research, focus groups, whatever, if you just think it looks right, then, I mean, it often works out that way. And it also means that you can probably push it a bit further because you haven't sort of gone down that route of trying to research the hell out of it and some people not like it and you go, oh, we're doing the wrong thing. So, yeah, I think fair play, yeah.
Next, I want to talk about your time on The Den, Dragon's Den. What was that experience all like?
Yeah, it was great. I actually really enjoyed it. It was something that I think the year before they asked me to do it. So they got in contact with me and straight away I sort of said no. I was like, nah, don't fancy this.
Well, they contacted you?
Yeah, they sent an email to our just inbox and it was like, oh, do you want to come on do a, you've still got to do a sort of interview test,
sure.
Audition, that's the word. Mm. So you still have to do a quick audition, but I was just like, nah, don't need it sort of thing. And then the second time, the following year, and weren't growing quite as quickly as I wanted to. So I was like, maybe, maybe not. And I didn't respond to the email, but then they chased me. And I was like, well, third time sort of thing. So it does make a difference when you chase people.
Was this just with Love Coco? This was before Hip?
Yeah, this is before Lip. So this was 4 or 5 years ago, I think it was. Mm-hmm. I think we're doing about £250,000 in revenue, so we're super small. And you didn't have any outside funding, so it was literally just me and my savings still. And we got to £250,000 from some £50,000 I invested to start with. But sort of to get to the next level, it's like, well, how can we do that? Do we try and raise some money? Or do we try and do clever little things like this? So I decided, only live once. Give it a go sort of thing. And I'm petrified of, or used to be petrified of doing any sort of interviews or, pitches or whatever else. And I remember at school, I was always called in sick and was like, oh, I've had to do any sort of presentations because I just hated them sort of thing. I remember doing one at uni. It was awful actually. So it was going out of my comfort zone. And I thought, to grow as a person and as a brand, I'm going to have to do things I'm not comfortable with. So eventually decided to say yes. On the day, I still wasn't sure if I was going to turn up. I was like, oh, should I do this? It was at the night before, actually. Then I was like, you know what? I'm here. I might as well give it a go. Then you go to the studio. So it was up in Salford, up in Manchester. And they get you in at 6 a.m. So it's quite an early start. And then you sort of set up your table and you're with all the other entrepreneurs and people who are pitching. I just remember hanging around all day and they don't tell you when you're going to go on. So it's great because I could literally practice my pitch and, I was practicing, I was perfect after about 100, 200 times I did it. And then I think I drank too much coffee and I started to, I knew I was going to be last on as well because there's no one else left in the green room. And then I was like, oh, let me pitch one more time or practice one more time to the lady who was looking after me. And suddenly I just couldn't remember my name. And I was like, oh my God, what have I done? She was like, oh, don't worry about it. You'll be fine. I was like, I'm not sure we'll be. She was like, I'll go and grab a glass of water. So when I grabbed a glass of water, she was like, oh, won't be on for 10, 15 minutes anyway. And suddenly she's like, actually, we need you in 2 minutes. You need to go in the lift. And I was like, oh God, here we go. And I remember going to the lift, not knowing what the company was called, how much I was going to ask for, because they asked me to change how much I was asking for just before I was going on. And I was in this lift and or room with sliding doors. And you could hear all the dragons getting ready, getting all their makeup done and sort of final checks and stuff. And not really religious, but I think I did say a little prayer to God. And I was just thinking, my mom told me not to do this. She said it was going to be a bad idea. And I was thinking, oh God, I'm going to embarrass my family sort of thing. And suddenly the doors...
I'm nervous just listening to you talk about this.
Better than the program.
They should do like the follow you sort of thing, how it's actually like. But then the doors opened and all the dragons were smiling, fair play to them, because they'd been there for 12 hours as well and they'd probably listened to some pretty rubbish pitches from speaking to a few people who were going on before me who didn't know what gross margin was. And luckily that gave me the confidence to get the pitch out. I memorized everything and got like 70% of it out. And I gave myself a 6, 7 out of 10. So it was definitely acceptable. It wasn't the best thing I could ever do, but I was like, minute before, I'd have definitely taken a 6 or 7 out of 10. So it was absolutely fine. And they got the gist of what I was pitching, luckily. And from there, after that, sort of answering questions, I find a lot easier to do rather than having to remember something in picture. I found a bit more daunting. And drones were all quite nice, actually. They were, on TV, they make it a bit more dramatic than I think it really is. But there's, I think it's like 50 people in there and probably 100 cameras. So any twitches or anything you do to make it more dramatic, then obviously they're going to pick up on that because at the end of the day, it's a TV entertainment program. And but no, I think it was great experience. It got us a few listings, got the brand out there. And it's something that got me out of my comfort zone. So I'd definitely recommend it to anybody who doesn't, you know, who doesn't have a huge amount of cash to invest in a business and is a product, consumer focused product business. I think it makes great sense to do it, really.
And did any of the dragons go for it? Or is that, you say, watch the program?
You can watch the program. I think it's on YouTube. But no, we got an offer quite early on from Tej, and then Peter also made an offer. So they were the two I really wanted. They played out a little bit different on TV, so it was a bit more dramatic than it probably was. But anyway, they got licensed to do what they want. But then after I decided not to go with it, they wanted a lot. And you're in there for about an hour and a half, I think I was in there for, and they condense it to 15 minutes. So you don't see some of the negotiations of, you know, sure. You know, I was like, well, if you want, you know, five times the amount of equity I was offering, well, what are you going to do? Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, a lot of discussion. Then you sort of go after and sort of, what can you actually do? And I just felt that we weren't going to get as much out of it as we needed to sort of take that offer. So decided not to go ahead with it. But, you know, on TV, we took the offer with Tej. And again, it's more of just a, you know, it's a TV program. Sure. There's no legals at that stage. And, but no, it was super nice actually. And he sort of understood why not. And, it was the right decision for both parties. I think so.
That's a great story. Really,
like that.
Really inspiring.
Yeah.
Nice one. What does the future hold for the two brands? What are your plans?
So HIP, we're really trying to scale that brand through grocery. So at the moment we're in Sainsbury's, which is going well. You know, we're really trying to, you know, pick up in terms of rate of sale. So, you know, improve that constantly, which is definitely going in the right direction, which is great. And it's really getting that second supermarket. So we are talking to a few. So hopefully something might come next year. And then scale as much as we can within UK grocery. I think there's a huge opportunity. So we've only sort of scratched the surface with our one listing in Sainsbury's. We're also looking for, you know, different chocolate. We could potentially products for HIP. So trying to be innovative as possible with that brand. So we've got some quite exciting stuff coming out next year, which will hopefully consumers will really like. And in terms of Love Cocoa, we're, you know, potentially looking to open a store next year. So again, it's something we're going to try this year, but with everything going on, we sort of delayed it. We did a rebrand and changed warehouses and whatever else, and we just, you know, want to concentrate on a few things rather than sort of spread ourselves too thin. So it'd be great to get that up and running, but it's sort of looking at the economy as well and making sure that it's the right time to open a shop. Sure. A lot of people got less money to spend, so that might be sort of end of next year. So sort of seeing what we can do towards the end of next year. But yeah, I think it's just trying to grow both brands, you know, get a great team to work with. I think it's so important to get the right team in to help grow both brands as we can. And yeah, I think it's quite exciting.
Absolutely. Great stuff. Well, a few questions just to wrap up with that we always like to ask our guests. Top tips for anyone looking to start a food or beverage brand in 2023 or 2024 is probably more appropriate now.
Yeah, no, really good. I think I thought about this recently, actually. I think if you are a food or beverage brand, you need to build an audience. I think gone the day you can just be anybody and try and set up a brand. I think that's going to be more and more hard. I think if you've got something really innovative, which is protectable, or if you're really first to market with it, then you've got a chance. But I think, you know, just looking at some, you know, prime energy drink, and there's other stuff coming out from the US, and I just think people are buying into, you know, people have got those audiences already, and, you know, makes such a big difference, especially when you're speaking to a retailer who doesn't have a huge amount of space on the shelf. So having that advantage, I'd say that's super important. So try and create a bit of an audience for yourself as much as you can. I know it's hard, but I'd say it's really important to try and to do that. So you've got people who are ready to buy your product for you. I'd say that's probably one of my biggest tips. And if you can't do that, then look at potentially doing options for influencers and stuff like that. Again, it might not work, but it's something we've considered in the past. We've not actually done, but I've heard it, you know, being used quite well for other brands, where you give away a little bit of percentage to a number of influencers and in response for some coverage. Or the way is to have something which is protectable, so via patent. But to get a patent in food is pretty tricky. I don't think there's too many things that can be
processes, really, isn't it?
You
can't really do a recipe.
Exactly, yeah. So I'd say, yeah, try and build that brand and that your sort of personal brand as well. Because I think, again, people buy into people more than probably products, especially when you're starting out. I'm not perfect at it, but there's people in the States, a company called Midday Squares, who these three, I think siblings, and they've set up basically a protein chocolate bar type thing, which is refrigerated, but they sort of document everything. So it's a bit like the Kardashians, but of the CPG. And if you haven't checked it out, check them out. They're crazy. They've got one sort of head cheerleader, I think he calls himself, called Jake, who's just crazy. And, you know, people buy into him. And if I saw his product on the show, you know, anywhere, I'd pick it up to try it, because just because he seems like a lot of fun. And
so keeping up with the Cadbury's, is that going to be the next Netflix series?
No chance. I'm not that sort of person, but it's, I wish I was a bit more outgoing, could do more of this sort of stuff, but I try and push myself as much as I can. And it's something I probably should try and do a little bit more of, because, I said, people do like to sort of see that journey. And again, people buy into people rather than products, especially when they're starting, I think.
Yeah, it's tough, isn't it, with that? Because I always think it's a balance, because with your story about time on the den, in that instance, you really push yourself to do something outside of your comfort zone, and that sort of paid off. But I also think that you've got to play to your strengths. Yeah. And I think sometimes people try to do everything or try to be someone just because they've seen someone else do it that way. And, you know, there is an element about you've got to kind of accept who you are, what your strengths are, and so it's a hard thing to balance sometimes. Sometimes push and other times not.
Yeah, I mean, we were talking earlier about other people who do the social media thing really well and create a lot of content, but these tend to be people who are just naturally, almost would do it anyway, even if they don't have a brand. Yeah.
Do you have a favourite brand outside of food or beverage that you admire in terms of how they operate, something they stand for, whether it's their marketing, their messaging, a campaign? What other brands do you...
Do you buy into?
That's a really good question, actually. Everybody probably says like Patagonia, obviously, got a great story behind them, and the sustainability, I think, was always the forefront in it. I think that took 30 years to build that business, and, you know, nowadays you see it and you think, oh, you know, it must have been a quick thing. But, you know, seeing brands which have taken the time grow into to big, you know, businesses, I think is super inspiring. And I think everybody just thinks that, you know, all these brands are sort of overnight successes, where actually it's a whole lot of hard work and graft. So I'll say Patagonia, but it's not really original, sorry.
No, that's good. That's really good. That's a good one. Desert island dish. What would that be?
I don't know, actually. I've no idea. I don't really have a favorite restaurant, because I like to try lots of different ones rather than sort of just sticking to one and going back. So, but if I was going to be put on the spot, some sort of Asian dishes, I really like the sort of, you know, the spiciness and fragrance and all that sort of stuff, which makes it delicious. So some sort of Asian, you know, maybe Japanese. I was there for my honeymoon recently. Maybe something from there, maybe some nice sushi to start with, and something like that.
Nice. What is one of the best bits of advice that you've had throughout your career?
Never give up is probably a good one. So we always, you experience tough times along the way, and it's how you deal with those tough times it makes the difference between you being successful or not. So I'd say, you know, when the chips are down, you know, make sure that's when you push harder. So I think that was something our PE teacher once told us, actually, rather than any business guru. But, you know, when you are, you know, you can apply it to business or sport, I guess, but when you're not performing well and things aren't going well, that's where you have to push the hardest, and that's what will, you know, make you succeed rather than the person to the left of you who sort of gives up, sort of thing. So something like that, I would say. And then also one, surround you with good people. So again, I probably didn't do this early enough, but get like a really good advisor on board. And it doesn't need to be someone who's a big CEO of a, you know, massive company or anything like that. It could literally be someone who's maybe 2-3 years ahead of you. I think actually those sort of people would probably be more, you know, would be better for your business than someone who's got a massive business. Because once it gets to a certain stage, then there's not a huge amount that you can learn from sort of straight away. It's more, that might be principles and whatever else, but someone who's been there and done it a couple of years, you know, ahead of you, that's where you can learn so much. So try and go to events where you can speak to fellow founders and, you know, people like that, and surround you with people like that, I'd say was something that someone once told me.
Nice. And finally, is there a podcast or a book or any other type of resource that you would recommend to our listeners or viewers?
Obviously your podcast.
First person who said that.
What else do I like in terms of book? I really like, I've read one recently, I think everybody's probably read it before, but is it Shoe Dog with the guy from Nike?
Yeah.
And I watched the movie on that recently as well, which I thought was really good.
Yeah, really good.
So learning from stuff like that, and again, with Nike, it took a long time. There's a lot of mishaps along the way, and I think the key to their success was persistence and you know, getting the right people in and people who are prepared to take risk as well. I think when they grew, it was because they took a big risk in terms of some of their marketing. So
fantastic. Well, James, it's been amazing to catch up with you, and so pleased to see that you're doing so well, not just with one brand, but with two brands. We'll wait to hear about the third brand or fourth brand probably next year.
No more brands. No more brands. But I do help my wife's brand. She's got a company called Kind Bag who do reusable bags, and worth checking out.
Nice, nice. We'll definitely put a link in the description. Thank you very much for the lovely calendars.
Yeah.
So happy to give you a plug there if people haven't. Well, it'd be a bit late now. Next year, definitely. But yeah, people in the office will be very happy with these. Thanks for coming on. Great to see you, and yeah, all the best.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please like and subscribe. And for more information, please visit tastehead.com. We hope you join us for our next episode.